Hammered, Book 3 in the Iron Druid Chronicles series. Written by Kevin Hearn and read by Christopher Ragland. Hammered. Druids are lesser beings, you see. But so far as such lesser beings are concerned, I do believe I'm the last one walking the earth. Unless you want to count all the happy, hippie neo-druids who do seem to love the earth but lack any real magic.
No, I meant druids like you.
Then there are none like me. Until you become one, if you live long enough.
I'll make it, Grognewail said. You gave me this completely unsexy amulet to make sure I do.
She lifted a teardrop of cold iron strung on a gold chain out from her shirt. The Morrigan had given it to me, and I had passed it on to my apprentice. That's not going to save you all the time, I reminded her.
I know. It seems to me that the thing to do is to simply disappear.
No, they'll still look for us.
Who are they?
The remaining Norse and any other gods who want to make a point that you can't kill gods with impunity.
What if they think we're dead? Will they still be looking for us then?
I sighed and smiled contentedly. You're a constant relief to me, you know? Every time you say something smart, it gives me hope that you might become the first new druid in more than 1,000 years. Chapter 1. According to popular imagination, squirrels are supposed to be adorable. As they scurry about on this tree branch or that trunk, people point at them and say, "Aw, how cute," with their voices turning sugary and spiraling up into falsetto ecstasy. But I'm here to tell you that they're cute only so long as they're small enough to step on. Once you're facing a giant bloody squirrel the size of a cement truck, they lose the majority of their charm. I wasn't especially surprised to be staring up at a set of choppers as tall as my fridge, twitching whiskers like bullwhips and tractor tire eyes staring me down like volcanic bubbles of India ink. I was simply horrified at being proven so spectacularly right. My apprentice, Grognewail, had argued I was imagining the impossible before I left her back in Arizona.
"No, Atticus," she'd said. "All the literature says the only way you can get into Asgard is the Bifrost Bridge. The Edda, the Skaldic poems, everything agrees that Bifrost is it."
"Of course that's what the literature says," I replied, "but that's just the propaganda of the gods. The Edda also tell you the truth of the matter if you read carefully. Ratatosk is the key to the back door of Asgard." Grognewail gazed at me, bemused, unsure that she'd heard me correctly.
"The squirrel that lives on the world tree?" she asked.
"Precisely. He manically scrambles back and forth between the eagle in the canopy and the great worm at the roots, ferrying messages of slander and vitriol between them, yada yada yada. Now ask yourself how it is that he manages to do that." Grognewail took a moment to think it through.
"Well, according to what the literature says, there are two roots of Yggdrasil that drop below Asgard. One rests in the Well of Mimir in Jotunheim, and one falls to the spring of Vergelmir in Nivelheim, beneath which the worm Nidhogg lies. So I assume he's got himself a little squirrely hole in there somewhere that he uses."
She shook her head, dismissing the point.
"But you won't be able to use that."
"I'll bet you dinner I can. A nice homemade dinner with wine and candles and fancy modern things like Caesar salad."
"Salad isn't modern."
"It is on my personal timescale. Caesar salad was invented in 1924. Grognewail's eyes bugged.
"How do you know these things?"
She waved off the question as soon as she asked it.
"No, you're not going to distract me this time. You're on. I bet you dinner. Now prove it or start cooking."
"The proof will have to come when I climb Yggdrasil's root, but," I said, raising a finger to forestall her objection, "I'll dazzle you now with what I think so that I'll seem fantastically prescient later. The way I figure it, Ratatosk has to be an utter badass. Consider. Eagles normally eat squirrels, and malevolent worms named Nidhogg are generally expected to eat anything. Yet neither of them ever tries to take a bite of Ratatosk. They just talk to him, never give him any guff at all, but ask him nicely if he'd be so kind as to tell their enemy far, far away such and such. And they say, "Hey, Ratatosk, you don't have to hurry. Take your time, please."
Okay, so you're saying he's a burly squirrel?
No, I'm saying he's turbo-burly. Paul Bunyan proportions, because his size is proportionate to the world tree. He's bigger than you and I put together. Big enough that Nidhogg thinks of him as an equal instead of as a snack. The only reason we've never heard of anyone climbing Yggdrasil's roots to get to Asgard is because you'd have to be nuts to try it.
Right, she said with a smirk. And Ratatosk eats nuts.
That's right. I bobbed my head once with a sardonic grin of my own.
Well then, Grognewel wondered aloud, exactly where are the roots of Yggdrasil anyway? I assume they're somewhere in Scandinavia, but you'd think they would have shown up on satellite by now.
The roots of Yggdrasil are on an entirely different plane, and that's really why no one has tried to climb them. But they're tethered to the Earth, just like Tir na n'og is, or the Elysian Fields, or Tartarus, or what have you. And coincidentally, a certain druid you know is also tethered to the Earth through his tattoos, I said, holding up my inked right arm. Grognewel's mouth opened in astonishment as the import of my words sank in, quick to follow the implication to its logical conclusion.
So you're saying you can go anywhere?
Uh-huh, I confirmed. But it's not something I brag about. I pointed a finger at her, nor should you, once you're bound the same way. Plenty of gods are already worried about me because of what happened to Angus Og and Bress. But since I killed them on this plane, and since Angus Og started it, they don't figure I've turned into a deicidal maniac. In their minds, I'm highly skilled in self-defense, but not a mortal threat to them, as long as they don't pick a fight. And they still believe that merely because they've never seen a druid in their territory before, they never will. But if the gods knew I could get to anyone, anywhere, my perceived threat level would go through the roof.
Can't the gods go anywhere?
Uh-uh, I said, shaking my head. Most gods can go only two places, their own domain and Earth. That's why you'll never see Kali in Olympus or Ishtar in Abhasara. I haven't visited even a quarter of the places I could go. Never been to any of the heavens. Went to Nirvana once, but it was kind of boring. Don't get me wrong, it's a beautiful plane, but the complete absence of desire meant nobody wanted to talk to me. Ma'mel is truly gorgeous. You gotta go there. And you've gotta go to Middle-earth to see the Shire.
Shut up! She punched me in the arm. You haven't been to Middle-earth.
Sure, why not? It's bound to our world like all the other planes. Elrond is still in Rivendell, because that's where people think of him being, not the Grey Havens. And I'm telling you right now, he looks nothing like Hugo Weaving. I also went to Hades once so I could ask Odysseus what the sirens had to say, and that was a mind-blower. Can't tell you what they said, though.
You're going to tell me I'm too young again, aren't you?
No, you simply have to hear it for yourself to properly appreciate it. It involves Hassenpfeffer and sea serpents in the end of the world. Grognewel narrowed her eyes at me and said,
Fine, don't tell me. So what's your plan for Asgard?
Well, first I have to choose a route to climb, but that's easy. I'd rather avoid Ratatosk, so I'm going up the one from Jotunheim. Not only does Ratatosk rarely travel it, but it's a far shorter climb from there than from Niflheim. Now, since you seem to have been reading up on this, tell me what direction I must go to find where the Well of Mimir would be bound to this plain.
East, Grognewel said immediately. Jotunheim is always to the east.
That's right, to the east of Scandinavia. The Well of Mimir is tethered to a subarctic lake some distance from the small Russian town of Nadim. That's where I'm going.
I'm not up to date on my small Russian towns. Where exactly is Nadim?
It's in western Siberia.
All right. You go to this particular lake. Then what?
There will be a tree root drinking from the lake. It will not be an ash tree, more of a stunted evergreen, because it's essentially tundra up there. Once I find this root, I touch it, bind myself to it, pull my center along the tether, and then I'm hugging the root of Yggdrasil on the Norse plain, and the lake will be the well of Mimir. Grognuel's eyes shone.
I can't wait until I can do this. And from there you just climb it, right? Because the root of the world tree has to be huge.
Yes, that's the plan.
So, how far from the trunk of Yggdrasil is it to Idun's place?
I shrugged. Never been there before, so I'm going to have to wing it. I've never found any maps of it. You'd think someone would have made an atlas of the plains by now, but no.
Grognuel frowned.
Do you even know where Idun is?
Nope, I said, a rueful smile on my face.
It's going to be tough to steal an apple for Laksha, then.
Yes, the prospect was daunting, but a deal was a deal. I had promised to steal a golden apple from Asgard in return for 12 dead Bakkans in Scottsdale. Laksha Kulaskaran, the Indian witch, had held up her end of the bargain, and now it was my turn. There was a chance I'd be able to pull off the theft without consequences, but there was no chance that I could renege on the deal and not face repercussions from Laksha. It'll be an adventure for sure, I told Grognuel. An adventure in squirrels, apparently. As I faced the stark reality of being so stunningly correct, gaping, slack-jawed at the colossal size of the rodent above me on the trunk of the world tree, an old candy bar jingle softly escaped my lips. Sometimes you feel like a nut, I crooned. Sometimes you don't. I'd really hoped Ratatos could be on the other route, or even hibernating by this time. It was November 25th, Thanksgiving, back in America, and Ratatosk looked like he'd already eaten Rhode Island's share of turkeys. He was properly stuffed and ready to sleep until spring. But now that he'd seen me, even if he didn't bite off my head with those choppers, he'd go tell somebody there was a man climbing up the route from Midgard, and then all of Asgard would know I was coming. It wouldn't be much of a stealth mission after that. I had been climbing Yggdrasil without tiring, binding knees, boots, and jacket to the bark all along the way and drawing power from it through my hands, because it was the world tree, after all, and synonymous with the earth once I'd shifted planes. While I was doing fine and not in any danger of falling off, I could not hope to match Ratatosk's speed or agility. I moved like a glacier in comparison, and Asgard was still miles away up the route. He chattered angrily at me, and his breath blew my hair back, filling my nostrils with the scent of stale nuts. I've smelled far worse, but it wasn't exactly fragrant either. There's a reason Bath & Body Works doesn't have a line of products called Huge Fucking Squirrel. I triggered a charm on my necklace that I call Fairy Specs, which allows me to view what's happening in the magical spectrum and see how things are bound together. It also makes creating my own bindings a bit easier, since I can see in real time the knots I'm tying with my spells. Ratatosk, I saw, was very firmly bound to Yggdrasil. In many ways, he was a branch of the tree, an extension of its identity, which I was dismayed to discover. Hurting the squirrel would hurt the tree, and I didn't want to do that, but I didn't see what choice I had. Unless I could get him to pinky swear he wouldn't tell anyone I was on my way to steal one of Idun's golden apples. I focused my attention on the threads that represented his consciousness and gently bound them to mine until communication was possible. I could still speak Old Norse, which was widely understood throughout Europe until the end of the 13th century, and I was betting Ratatosk could speak it too, since he was a creation of Old Norse minds. "I greet you, Ratatosk," I sent through the binding I'd made. He flinched at the words in his head and whirled around, the brush of his tail whipping my face as he scrambled up the route a few quick strides before whirling around again, regarding me warily. Maybe I should have moved my mouth along with the words.
"Who in hell's frosty realm are you?" came the reply.
the squirrel's massive whiskers all twitching in agitation.
"Why are you on the root of the world tree?"
Since I was coming up the route from the middle plain, there were only three places I could possibly be coming from. I wasn't a frost giant from Jotunheim, and he'd never believe I was an ordinary mortal climbing the route, so I had to tell a stretcher and hope he bought it. "I am an envoy sent from Nidavellir, realm of the dwarfs," I explained. "I am not flesh and blood, but rather a new construct. Thus my flame-red hair and the putrid stench that surrounds me." I had no idea what I smelled like to him, but since I was decked out in new leathers with their concomitant tanning odors, I figured I smelled like a few dead cows at least, and it was best from a personal safety perspective to frame my scent in person in terms of something inedible. The Norse dwarfs were famous for making magical constructs that walked around looking like normal critters, but often these creatures had special abilities. They'd made a boar once for the god Freyr, one that could walk on water and ride the wind, and it had a golden mane around its head that shone brightly in the night. They called it Gudelinbürste, which meant golden bristles. Go figure. "My name is Eldar, crafted by Eikenskjaldi, son of Yngvi, son of Fjallar," I told him. The three dwarf names were mined straight from the poetic Edda. Tolkien found the names of all his dwarfs in the same source, in addition to Gandalf's, so I saw no reason why I couldn't appropriate a few of them for my own use. Eldar, the name I'd given for myself, meant nothing more than fire hair. I figured since I was pretending to be a construct, it would be consistent with names like Gudelinbürste. "I am on my way to Valhalla, at the Dwarf King's request to speak to Odin Allfather, One-Eyed Wanderer, Grey Runecrafter, Sleipnir Rider, and Gungnir Wielder. It is a matter of great importance regarding danger to the Norns."
"The Norns?"
Ratatosk was so alarmed by this that he actually became still for a half second.
"The three who live by the Well of Urd?"
"The same. Will you aid me in my journey and thus speed this most vital embassy so that the World Tree may be spared any neglect?" The Norns were responsible for watering the tree from the well, a sort of constant battle against rot and age.
"Gladly will I take you to Asgard," Ratatosk said.
He switched directions again and shimmied backward courteously, extending his back leg to me and carefully holding his bushy tail out of the way.
"Can you climb upon my back?"
It took me longer than I might have wished, but eventually I clambered up his back, bound myself tightly to his red fur, and pronounced myself ready to ride.
"We go,"
Ratatosk said simply, and we shot up the trunk with a violent gait so awkward that I think I might have bruised my spleen. Still, I could not complain. Ratatosk was even more than I had imagined. In addition to being extraordinarily large and speedy, he was perfectly gullible and willing to help strangers, so long as they spoke Old Norse. Perhaps I wouldn't have to kill him after all. Chapter 2. Most visual representations of Norse cosmology are based on the principle of, you can't get there from here. That's because their cosmology isn't magical merely in the sense that it defies all science. It's also internally inconsistent, so that planewalkers like me tie themselves in knots trying to get around. For example, in some sources, Hell is in Niflheim, the elemental realm of ice, and in others, Hell is in its own domain separate from Niflheim. So you'd literally have to be in two places at once if you wanted to drop by for a visit. Muspelheim, the realm of fire, is just south, but no one seems to know how to get there. Luckily, I didn't need or want to go to either place. I had to get to Asgard and bring back one of Idun's golden apples for Laksha so she wouldn't invade my brain and switch it off. I didn't know if she could invade my brain or not. I hoped my amulet would protect me, but it's not the sort of thing you invite someone to do on a dare. Ratatosk was taking me in the right direction, so I was confident that I'd make it to Asgard, bruised spleen or not. What would happen once I got there would probably be a surprise. The worst-case scenario would be that I'd arrive as all the gods were in council by the Well of Urd, right near the Norns, and Ratatosk would dump me in front of them all and say, "Hey, everybody! Eldar here has some bad news from Nidav Vedelir," and then I'd get my ass handed to me in short order. Perhaps I should try to avoid that. "Ratatosk, how long before we are in Asgard?" I asked him as we bounded up the great tree root. It was far, far thicker than a sequoia, but gray and smooth-barked instead of red, and etched with crenellations.
"Less than an hour,"
the squirrel replied.
"My, that's fast. Odin will surely commend you for your speed when I tell him how you helped me.
Might you know if the gods are in council by the Well of Urd at this time?"
"They are early risers. Surely they are finished by now. But the Norns will still be there. Why not simply tell them what the trouble is? Hey!"
Ratatosk stopped suddenly, halted by the intrusion of a disconcerting thought, and if I had not bound myself to his fur, I would have flown upward for a brief time before gravity pulled me back down.
"Shouldn't the Norns be able to see this danger coming? Why do we have to warn anyone?"
Clearly, Ratatosk could not think and run at the same time. "This danger comes from outside Asgard," I explained, then spun him a lie. "The danger comes from the Romans. The Roman fates, the Parcae, have sent Bacchus and his pards to slay the Norns, knowing that the Norns will not be able to see him coming."
"Oh."
Ratatosk leapt forward again, but then halted abruptly after a few steps, as another thought locked down his motor functions.
"Why does the Dwarf King know about this and Odin doesn't?"
Damn inquisitive squirrel. "He found out from the King of the Dark Elves. The entire evil plot was hatched in their, evil minds. When in doubt, blame the Dark Elves."
"Oh,"
Ratatosk said knowingly. I got the sense that he thought the Dark Elves could keep secrets from Odin if anyone could.
"When is Bacchus coming?"
"The Dwarf King believes he may already be on his way. Time is of the essence. Let your haste commend your duty, Ratatosk."
"I shall."
Reassured and reinvigorated, Ratatosk leapt up the root of Yggdrasil even faster than before.
"Is Bacchus a powerful god?"
"It is said that heroes have shat kine at the very sight of him. He drives men to madness. But I do not know how he would fare against the Norns. The danger is in the surprise he represents. If the Norns cannot see him coming, then he may be able to catch them unprepared. Their best defense will be my warning, and with your help, all the gods of Asgard will have time to prepare a proper welcome for the upstart Roman."
"I hope I will be there to see it,"
Ratatosk said with delicious anticipation.
"It has been far too long since the gods have taken anyone's nuts."
His euphemism startled me, until I remembered that I was talking to a squirrel. I confirmed through the images and emotions in our mental bond that he was using the expression to mean the defeat of an enemy, nothing more. I affirmed his thoughts and then fell silent as I considered the very real possibilities behind my lies. The Norns would be waiting by the trunk of Yggdrasil as we ascended to Asgard. I was certain they'd not know that it was I who was coming, not because I was a god like Bacchus from a different pantheon, but because my amulet protected me from divination. Yet they'd probably know Ratatosk would be bringing someone or something with him at this particular time. They'd be curious, at the very least, paranoid at the worst, and if the latter was true, they might have planned something unpleasant. They might even send someone down the trunk to see who was riding on Ratatosk. As soon as I thought of it, I cast camouflage on myself, my clothes, and my sword as a precautionary measure. The Norse shouldn't be able to penetrate it, if the mythology was to be believed. They were continually fooling one another in the Edda with basic disguises, much less magical ones. We still had a decently long trek ahead of us, which suggested to me it was an ideal time for a fishing expedition. I told Ratatosk that my creator, Eikon Skjaldi, had given me only basic knowledge of Asgard. Would he be so kind as to fill in some gaps in my information? The squirrel was agreeable, so I peppered him with questions from the old myths. Was Loki still bound with his own son's entrails? Yes. Was the Bifrost Bridge still functional, and did the god Heimdall still guard it? Yes. Had the eagle and the worm run out of insults for each other yet?
Not by a long shot, Ratatosk chuckled. Want to hear the latest?
Do tell.
Nidhogg says the eagle is a cream-shitting feather duster that doesn't even know its own name.
That's a good one, I acknowledged. Accurate, yet succinct. Did the eagle offer a riposte?
Yes, the eagle had a reply. I was on my way down to deliver it, but the Norns told me to come down this route instead to find something unusual. Hey!
He stopped again.
They must have been talking about you, because you're pretty weird.
It's been remarked upon before, I admitted.
Well then, they know you're coming, so that's good, Ratatosk said,
then began sprinting up the route once more. I didn't agree that this was good. Confirmation that the Norns were expecting me sounded extraordinarily bad.
Anyway,
the squirrel continued,
the eagle said, Nidhogg can stick the left fork of his tongue into my cloaca and taste what I think about having a name. But I think he said something very similar 300 years ago.
What an odd relationship they have. Speaking of odd relationships, why is Idun married to Bragi, the god of poets? It wasn't a subtle way to introduce the true object of my foray into Asgard, but I had a feeling Ratatosk didn't require subtlety. The squirrel slowed noticeably while he thought it over, but he didn't stop this time.
I suppose it is because they enjoy mating together,
he said, then sped up again. That is undoubtedly part of it, I conceded, but I think their lives must be very inconvenient. Do not Idun's apples grow far from the city of Asgard, and therefore far from Bragi's audience of the gods? Ratatosk chattered shrilly, which startled me at first, until I felt through our bond that he was amused. That sound had been his laughter.
No one knows where they grow. That is a closely guarded secret. But they do live far from Asgard.
Ah, then my point is made. Where do they live?
North of the Asgard Mountains. They live on the border between Vanaheim and Alfheim. Their hall is on the Vanaheim side, and on the other side lies the Hall of Freyr. You can't miss it.
I can't. Why?
Because at night, the mane of the great boar Gudlinbursti lights up the sky, even from inside his stable.
I was told Freyr's hall was on Alfheim, but I did not think it would be right on the border. I would like to visit this Gudlinbursti, since he is a construct like myself, but my creators have told me little except how to get to Gladsheim. Perhaps I will visit after I deliver my message. How would I get to Freyr's hall from Gladsheim?
Run due north,
Ratatosk said. I'd been told nothing about Asgard from anyone, of course, but by inquiring about the locations of all the famous halls and landmarks from the sagas in relation to Gladsheim, I could gradually gather a sense of the plain's layout and thus make my way around. I think I felt a brief twinge of guilt at taking advantage of the furry fella's gullibility, but I ruthlessly smooshed it and kept asking questions. Information increased my chances of escape without incident, and besides, Ratatosk was full of juicy gossip about the gods. Heimdall was spending a lot of time in Freyja's hall recently. Freyja's cats had just had kittens, but Odin's dogs had eaten 3 of them. And Odin didn't want anyone to mention Baldur in his presence ever again.
Speaking of Odin, there's Hugin and Munin circling around.
Where?
Look to your left.
2 distant black shapes chopping the cerulean sky indicated the presence of Odin's ravens. He saw whatever they saw, and I wondered if they could see through my camouflage. I really hoped they couldn't. I see them now, I said to Ratatosk.
Your message is for Odin, right? Why don't you just tell them?
I can't speak to them like I can speak to you. I probably could, but the last thing I wanted to do was bind myself, however indirectly, with the mind of Odin.
You can't? Well, I can relay a message for you. Just tell me what to say.
The black specks were growing larger. I couldn't dodge by saying, I have to give my message to Odin personally, because those ravens were, in a very real sense, Odin himself. They were thought and memory. Time to lie some more, and blame the Dark Elves. Tell them that Bacchus is coming to slay the Norns, I said. The Dark Elves and Svartalheim are working with the Romans to get Bacchus into Asgard through a secret tunnel they have been digging for a century. I will give him all the details when I arrive at his throne in Gladsheim.
All right. I will tell them.
We stopped abruptly so that Raditas could concentrate on talking to the ravens, however he managed such a thing. I didn't hear him make a sound. But after a few seconds, the ravens banked around and returned the way they had come.
Odin is angry,
Raditas said, running up the tree again.
But he will await your arrival at Gladsheim.
Thank you, I said. I wanted Odin in Gladsheim rather than at his other residence, Valaskjalf. He had a silver throne there named Hlidskjalf, and legend had it that he could see everything from there. Maybe even camouflage druids.
It will not be very much longer,
Raditas added.
Soon we will be in the bones of Yggdrasil and emerge above ground in Asgard.
I looked upward and had difficulty focusing on anything much due to severe squirrel turbulence. All I could make out was that the sky above was gone. We had ascended into the shadow of a huge tract of land. It was the plain of Asgard. Gritty rocks buttressed clumps of rich brown earth, and wispy roots waved dryly in the wind, like the fine hair that grows wild and unheeded from the edges of old men's ears. There was no space between the earth above and the trunk of Yggdrasil, no place for the squirrel to go, and I thought he was going to ram us into it, or else keep chugging through one of those neato optical illusions that Bruce Wayne had in front of his cave. But instead, he slithered into a large hole in the root of the world tree, invisible until we were on top of it, and for a brief time, half a gasp, we were horizontal in a sort of scoop, a small concavity at the base of a long wooden throat that yawned above us. The back wall was smooth, but the floor we rested on was rugged and littered with the shells of nuts and shed fur. Piles of uneaten nuts and a rough nest of leaves could be seen in a smaller area that winked dimly through a short passage. I assumed I was looking at the place where Raditas rested during the winters. The inside wall, or rather the opposite side of the root's outer bark, was scarred and pitted and ideal for climbing, and Raditas flipped himself and me around so that he could ascend using that surface. We rose through a Stygian shroud of black, its only sense of depth coming from a hollow whistling of wind passing through my hair. How long will we travel in the dark? I asked Raditas.
In a moment you will begin to see the light, the squirrel replied. That will be the hole in the root above the grassy plain of Idaval.
How far above the plain?
Only a squirrel's length.
You mean your length?
Of course. If the hole were at ground level, there would be mud in here.
I see the light now. Excellent. You are, without a doubt, the finest of squirrels.
Thank you,
Raditas replied, sounding at once embarrassed and proud. He was such an agreeable fellow, and I smiled briefly at the top of his head before frowning at the light. The unavoidable problem of the Norns grew closer with every leap upward. I could not coach Raditas out of this. Whatever he did, the Norns would foresee it. But now I feared that they truly shared my paranoia, and that in their eagerness to attack me, the unseen, uncertain danger on Raditas' back, they would willingly accept collateral damage wounding both friend and foe. I did not want Ratatosk to come to harm, but neither did I want to have him stop. They would be prepared for such an event. As it stood, he was bringing me directly to them, where they could easily attack me astride the squirrel, flat against the trunk like a target. Bugger it all. Ratatosk scurried out of the hole in the root and headed down the outside surface, and as soon as I saw the earth perhaps 10 feet below, I unbound myself from his fur and leapt off, somersaulting in the air so as to land on my feet. A hoarse shouted curse and a flash of light startled me in midair. Then I heard and felt Ratatosk scream as I landed, the sting of impact flaring in my ankles and knees. As the squirrel's cries continued, I dropped and rolled to my right, expecting to be crushed underneath him as he fell from the tree. But that didn't happen. His voice cut off abruptly, the bond between our minds snapped, and I glanced up to see naught but a flurry of ashes and bone fragments raining down from the place where he'd clung to the world tree. My mouth gaped, and I think I might have whimpered. The Norns had obliterated him completely, a creature they'd known for centuries because of me. It was like watching Rudolph get shot by Santa Claus. Clearly, the Norns must have thought I represented a dire threat to act so rashly. I tore my eyes away from the horror and watched them warily, keeping still to maximize the effect of my camouflage. They couldn't see me. Their blazing yellow eyes, smoke curling from their sockets, were still fixed above my head on Ratatosk's swirling remains. They were stooped hags with claw-like fingers, and their faces bore frenzied expressions that mothers warn their children not to make in case they freeze that way. Dressed in dirty gray rags that matched the greasy strings of hair falling from their scalps, they advanced carefully on the tree to make sure the danger they'd foreseen had passed. It hadn't. It wasn't long before they vocalized this. One of them tilted her head upon a wattled neck and said,
"He is still here. The danger remains."
Danger to whom? I hadn't come to throw down with them. I just wanted some extremely rare produce. They all deserved a swift kick in the hoo-ha for what they had done to Ratatosk, but much as I wanted to deliver it, I didn't see an upside to picking a fight with them when they could vaporize giant rodents. I took a step to my right, an overture to running away, but they must have spied the movement, for their heads all snapped down to lock directly on me with jaundiced, egg-yolk eyes.
"He is there!"
the middle one cried, pointing, and then in unison they sang out in a truly ancient language and threw open their hands at me, their dirty fingernails releasing a foul dust into the air. I didn't know precisely what the dust was supposed to accomplish. Most likely it was my demise. Perhaps in their old age and infirmity they thought they were throwing confetti at me, but their behavior did not seem all that warm and welcoming. Rather the opposite, in fact. My cold iron amulet flashed hot for a second, confirming that they had just tried to kill me, and my stomach twisted oddly in my guts, causing me to fart robustly. Normally, I laugh at such things, because there's nothing like a fart to lighten up a tense situation. But this one hadn't been a natural result of my digestion. It was a deadly serious fart, a sign that some small fraction of the Norn's magic was getting past my amulet, perhaps a single speck of that dust, and that worried me.
"He's still alive!"
the one on the right cursed, and that dispelled any lingering doubts about their intentions. I probably should have run for it, but then if I escaped, they'd raise the alarm and all of Asgard would be searching for me. That wouldn't end well. Strategically, logically, and even instinctively, in self-defense, I had to take them out. And once a decision like that is made in a moment of crisis, there is no such thing as calm, reasoned execution. There is only action, fueled by the baser parts of our brains. The rags on the Norn's bony frames were natural woolen fibers, and as such, lent themselves to easy manipulation. As the Norns shoved their claws into pockets for more dust and began to chant something different and more dire in their old tongue, I murmured a binding for the material at their shoulder blades, so that when I finished and willed it done, they were abruptly pulled back to back and held in place like a hissing human triangle. That disrupted their spell and caused some wailing and gnashing of teeth. I paused. I almost left them there, bound only by their clothes, seemingly impotent for now. But then abruptly they calmed down and began to rotate in a circle, chanting something low and venomous. Each Norn in turn faced me and pulled a thread from the front of her garment, passing it to her sister on the left. They began to weave the threads, pulling and twisting and chanting all the while as they spun. It was seven kinds of creepy, and I knew I couldn't let them finish whatever they were doing, because it would likely finish me. I drew Moralta and charged, not caring if they heard me. Their yellow eyes widened as they heard my approach, but they didn't stop chanting their spell, so I couldn't allow myself to stop either. I swept Moralta through their necks in a single broad sweep. Their heads sailed away like ragged balls of gray twine, and thus were the Norse unyoked from the chains of destiny. And thus was I plunged into a galactic vat of doom. "Damn it!" I shouted, frustrated beyond belief at how badly this had played out. I released my binding and let the bodies slump as they may. I slumped to the ground after them, dragged down by the weight of what I'd just done. When you steal an apple, you can simply disappear. That had been my plan. But slay a manifestation of fate, and they will find you, as Hans Gruber pointed out in Die Hard. I chewed over the idea of aborting the mission. It had a nice, light flavor to it, a piquant savor of surprise. I could try my hand at being unemployed in Greenland. Maybe that would keep me off the radar. Laksha would never find me there, I felt sure. But the Norse probably would. And Oberon would be miserable. There was the bitter aftertaste. Still, I had time to think of something better. I had until New Year's to get the golden apple. Laksha wouldn't start looking for me until then, and that would allow me to plan a thorough disappearance. Except that then I would be running from both Laksha and the Norse. Whether I liked it or not, killing the Norns in self-defense made me an enemy of the whole pantheon. Stealing an apple at this point couldn't hardly make it worse. That being the case, I decided to see the mission through and at least expunge my debt to Laksha. I wiped Moralta clean on one of the Norns' gowns and resheathed it before squatting down and sinking my fingers through fallen leaves into the springy turf of Asgard, which was surprisingly akin to a moor, at least in the immediate vicinity of Yggdrasil. The Norns' bodies had turned sickeningly black. I spoke to the earth through my tattoos, and it acknowledged me, though it felt strained and far away, as if it had to struggle through a layer of cheesecloth. Obediently it parted to let the bodies of the Norns sink into its peaty depths, and obediently it closed again, leaving no trace of what had happened to them. That chore done, I scoured the earth around the base of the tree to find a few small remnants of Ratatosk, the finest of squirrels. I was glad I had left him feeling good about himself. I carefully placed the fragments of bone in a pouch attached to my belt. Later, I would say words for him. The Norns would be missed when the gods held their council in the morning, so I had until then to steal a golden apple and get out of Dodge. I couldn't afford to linger, but I took a moment to look up at the towering trunk of Yggdrasil and fix in my memory my avenue of escape. Its size beggared the imagination. Extending for miles in either direction, it gave the illusion of being an immense wooden wall rather than a cylinder. I assumed that there must be another hole in the trunk somewhere that Ratatosk used to access the route that led to Niflheim. A few minutes' jog counterclockwise found it, and I noted that it looked a bit larger and more well-used than the other one. Satisfied that I wouldn't confuse the two holes and take the wrong exit home, I followed the directions Ratatosk had given me. Not to Gladsheim, but rather directly to Idun's hull. I ran west and slightly south toward the northernmost range of the Asgard Mountains, and if I got there after nightfall, which seemed likely, I could hope for Gudelinburst's mane to act as a homing beacon. I leached a wee bit of power from the earth with every step to keep myself fresh and tireless. I'd probably arrive there as Odin was working the gods into a froth over rumors of betrayal in Svartalfheim and invasion from a Roman god. I had kicked the Norse ant hill a good one, and now the gods would come spilling out, seeking something to bite. Chapter 3. In many ways, I'm disappointed that Star Trek never became a religion. The archetypal skeleton was there, but they never strove to make it anything more than a TV show. If they'd capitalized on it, then its adherents would have orders from the nebulous gods of the Federation to explore new worlds and boldly go where no one has gone before. The crew of the Enterprise could have been minor gods, angels perhaps, guiding us through our personal frontiers on a daily basis. Spock could have been the angel of logic on your left shoulder, pointing out fallacious reasoning and suggesting courses of action based on mountains of evidence, while Kirk could have been the angel of emotion on your right shoulder, exhorting you to gird your loins, check your gut, and follow your instincts. "Kill 'em all, Atticus," imaginary Kirk said in my right ear. "One blow from Moralta is all it takes. They can't see you. It'll be easy." "That would be unwise," imaginary Spock said to the fragments of cartilage dangling on my left. A German witch had shot off most of my left ear 3 weeks ago, and while the healing was going better than the time a demon had chewed off my right one, it still didn't look very good. "A better course of action would be to complete the mission stealthily. The probability of injury or death increases exponentially once your presence is discovered, coupled with time for the alarm to spread." Kirk kissed his self-control goodbye.
"Damn it, Spock! We're on a different plane of existence here, and sometimes you just have to say fuck it and let your ball swing heavy, free, and low. Right, Atticus? Kill 'em all! For Ratatosk!"
"Captain, our mission here is to purloin an apple that confers the vitality of youth to those who consume it. Nothing more. Wholesale slaughter is neither advisable nor necessary."
"What is it with you, Spock? Always prudence and caution and tiptoeing through the tulips. Don't you have any stones in your Vulcan panties?"
"My reproductive organs are both present and in perfect working order, Captain. But that is hardly germane to our discussion. One cannot solve every problem through sheer machismo and violence."
"Why not? It works for Chuck Norris."
This is how I entertain myself when I have to run for hours and I can't worry anymore about the 99 ways I could die. I should have brought an iPod. The Moorish domain of Yggdrasil gave way beneath my churning feet to the plain of Idaval, an impressive expanse of untamed grassland that hid plump pheasants, prairie voles, and sleek red foxes. Clouds hung like torn cotton in an achingly blue sky, and a late autumn breeze blew scents of grass and earth in my face. It was a lovely day, but I could not enjoy it. A novice tracker could follow the trail I was leaving with little difficulty, and even though it was a planned tactic in the coming game of seek and destroy the intruder, I couldn't help but feel nervous about it. I caught myself wishing that Scotty, the patron saint of all travelers, could simply beam me across the plain to Idun's hall. Teleportation was his godlike power. That, and getting his engines not only to warp speed, but to warp speed faster with nothing more than some auxiliary tubes and mysterious bypasses. People used to think that druids were capable of teleportation, but of course that's nonsense. I've never disintegrated my atoms in one place and reassembled them in another. I have, however, run tirelessly for miles, as I was currently doing, faster than any normal man could huff and puff. And I've cheated by taking shortcuts through Tir na n'Og
where any grove can be bound to any fey woodland on Earth. Fey, in the sense that it's a healthy forest. Getting to Russia from Arizona took me less than 5 minutes. I shifted planes to Tirnanog, found the knots that led to a forest in Siberia, like a railroad in my sight, then pulled myself along them until I was standing on the other side of the globe, in the land of borscht and amusing furry hats. In order to make that shift, however, I'd had to get down to the Aravaipa Canyon wilderness from Tempe, and that had taken me nearly 2 hours. And once in Russia, in a proper forest, it was a healthy 3-hour trip overland to the high tundra lake bound to the Well of Mimir. There were new shortcuts for me now. I'd have to run everywhere. But that, I came to decide, was not necessarily a bad thing. My longing for teleportation waned as I grew accustomed to the feel of the earth and the flow of magic beneath it. As far as ontological projections of human angst about the afterlife go, Asgard is one of the nicer ones. It is somewhat spare in its diversity of life, like the frozen lands the Norse hail from, but it is sharply rendered, redolent of mystery, and a bite of danger wafts about in the air. Admittedly, the danger part might have been something I was projecting onto the wind. This wasn't a fun run. It was insanely perilous. Ratatosk had told me I would know immediately when I'd reached Vanaheim. For one thing, the purple teeth of the Asgard Mountains would loom large in front of me. And for another, the plain of Idavol would give way to harvested fields, idyllic farmland dotted with bright points of color on the horizon, where barns and granaries rested like the desultory afterthoughts of an impressionist brush, all waiting for winter's first snow. I arrived there as the sun was setting in front of me, and I marveled at the imagination of the Norse, who thought that things like the sun and gravity and weather would behave the same way on a floating plane attached to an ash tree as they did on Earth. Still, they'd imagined their paradise well. If I wasn't about to become the Norse's most wanted, I would have liked to linger there a while. I kept running past the twilight songs of birds and cast night vision to save myself from injury. I had run for more than 8 hours straight at 10 miles per hour, and now the Asgard Mountains were close, jutting up into the early evening like towering ziggurats. Another mile earned me a glimpse of a pale yellow glow shining just north of west over the canopy of a forest I was fast approaching. It was either a very large campfire, which I deemed unlikely, or it was the golden mane of Gudelnburste. Deciding I had run a bit too far south, I altered my course to head straight for it, and before long I stopped for the first time since I'd left the Norns. There was a river to cross here. It definitively marked the traditional border of Vanaheim, according to Ratatosk. I didn't relish a swim, but I didn't appear to have a choice. Flying across as an owl would mean leaving almost everything behind. I shrugged, sighed, and waded in. Everything that needed to be dry was safely tucked into a waterproof pouch anyway. Fortunately, it was a slow stretch of river, its current not particularly strong, and even weighted down with my clothes and sword, I was able to manage without much trouble, aside from the chill. I admit it, there was shrinkage. Figuring the best cure for shivering would be to resume running, I jogged for maybe 40 yards toward the pale light before I had to stop again. Just before I entered the trees, the glow flared brightly, and something launched itself from the woods. A blinding phosphorus comet streaked into the sky, followed by a rolling rumble of thunder and a dark cloud bank that had not been there moments before. I remained still, dripping onto the earth and getting colder, because those particular flying objects were gods, and they were probably looking for me. It was the fertility god Freyr, riding on the back of Gudelnburste, and behind him came Thor in his chariot, pulled by 2 goats. They were headed toward Yggdrasil. I waited until they were almost out of sight before moving again. I continued straight on my northwesterly path, now sure that I was headed in the right direction,
and positive that I didn't have far to go. That was good, because my timetable had just accelerated. I'd been hoping to be gone before anyone discovered the Norns were missing, but that seemed unlikely now. How fast they picked up my trail depended entirely on how fast they set the god Heimdall the task of finding me. He had superlative senses that made him an excellent tracker. If he was nearby, I had no doubt he'd be able to hear my heartbeat and smell my anxiety. There was nothing for it but to proceed quickly. I suspected that Odin had seen through my ruse by now. He'd had plenty of time to figure out that Bacchus wasn't coming, and the Dark Elves hadn't done anything. Still, he didn't know who or what I was, what my goal was, or where I was. Thus, Thor and Freyr were going to Yggdrasil on a fact-finding mission, perhaps along with other gods as well, but not Odin himself. I'd bet Odin was on his way to his Silver Throne right now, if he wasn't there already. He'd want to search for me and dispatch a proper welcoming party. So that's why I had to act now, before he had a chance to see all from his throne. Raditosk had been a bit hazy on the distance between Gladsheim and Valaskjalf, so there was no telling how much time I had left. The unmannerly chaos of the woods changed after 4 miles to measured orchards and stately rows. The branches of pear trees, plums, apples, and more bore silent witness to my passage. And then a slow, deep river curled into view, perhaps the same one I'd crossed earlier. Suspecting this served as the border between Vanaheim and Alfheim, I kept to the south side of it and looked for halls nestled on either shore. Another mile brought me to them. On the north side of the river, Freyr's hall seemed to grow like a sturdy oak in the middle of a lush garden still blooming late into November. It appeared organically grown rather than constructed, yet I could still discern that here were walls and a watertight roof, as comfortable and secure as any other hall. Spaced randomly about the grounds on carved wooden pedestals were woven baskets overflowing with produce. We nocturnal animals were taking advantage of these offerings, and an owl swooped down to take advantage of the wee nocturnal animals. The warm glow of Freyr's hearth fire could be seen through the windows, which were open to the air, as was his door. A path led from his step to the boundary of his garden, which then turned south and widened to kiss the edge of a sturdy, handsome bridge floating above the river. Bold planks would allow 3 to walk abreast upon it, or it could support large animals and carts. The path continued on my side of the river once the bridge touched the shore. It led straight to a stouter, smaller hall, clearly constructed rather than grown, but every inch of it was carved with runes and scenes of brave Viking deeds. I crept closer until I could read the runes. They were skalds of one form or another, proclaiming the halls to be that of Idun and Bragi, long may they live and love and so on. My art appreciation was curtailed by the sound of low, intense voices coming from the hall. The door and windows were open, just like Freyr's, and the fire inside was more for its light than its warmth. "Get closer," imaginary Kirk said. "I want to hear what they're saying." "I agree," said imaginary Spock. "The additional intelligence might prove to be useful." I told them both I liked it better when they argued, as I picked my way carefully forward, until I was crouching underneath the front window of the hall. The warm, rich voice of a woman fluttered into my ears.
"What this means? If the Norns are truly dead, then their prophecies may be null. We could be truly free. Bragi, think of it."
A sonorous baritone voice rumbled contemplatively.
"Ragnarok, null?"
A loudy thump and the scrape of chair legs on a wooden floor suggested someone had sat down heavily.
"Perhaps, then, there is hope for us all."
"Yes,"
the woman enthused. I assumed her to be a Dune.
"And there is hope for us specifically. Do you not understand? Perhaps we could finally have a child. The doom they laid upon us may have died with them.
I heard kissing noises, and then a throaty chuckle from the baritone.
Ah, I see. Only one way to find out, isn't there?
The kissing noises became more frequent, and these were shortly followed by other, less chaste noises and heavy breathing. I sank dejectedly onto my haunches, realizing this might take a while. These were not teenagers who finished such business in a few frenzied minutes. The long-lived knew how to love long. But the brief snatch of conversation I'd overheard gave me plenty to think about. Idun had implied that the two of them were cursed with infertility, and their current behavior implied that they couldn't wait to get rid of that curse. Moreover, it implied that they were still in love. Mortals never got a chance to see if their love would last for centuries, but clearly Idun and Bragi's had. At first, I felt a bit envious, and then heart-achingly so for the memories it stirred. There had been a woman in Africa once whom I loved for more than 200 years. Upon returning to the fringes of Eastern Europe with the hordes of Genghis Khan, I'd quickly ascertained that there was little to be gained by staying there. So, I crossed Arabia instead, a strange infidel in the Caliphate, then delved deep into the African continent and lost myself in that wondrous land of savanna and jungle and desert. I did not reemerge until the 15th century, happily missing the Black Death in the process. Even more happily for me, Angus Oak lost track of me for that whole time. Were I superstitious, perhaps I'd assign the credit for that to my love. More likely, I had made enough progress on my amulet to shield me from his divination, and until he thought of new ways to track me, I was safe. The source of my long attraction to Tahira had been perfectly matched chemistry, of course, the same frisson that clearly existed between the Norse gods now snogging behind me. Her sharp wit kept up with mine, and her soft, dark eyes soothed my restlessness and chained me willingly to her side. Her low, musical voice entered my ears like new velvet, and her laugh was so pure that it struck a tuning fork against my bones and gave me shuddering chills down my spine. She was the last person with whom I'd shared immortality. Over the 2 centuries of our marriage, she gave me 25 children, all of them a joy. I regretted nothing. Perhaps we would still be in love today, still making babies and trying to keep the young ones from inadvertently marrying the descendants of the old ones. I'm sorry, honey, but you can't marry him. He's the great-great-grandson of your brother, you see, who was born back in 1842. I would never know. The Maasai war party we stumbled across ended our chance at eternal love. The renewed scraping of the chair leg interrupted my reverie, and I heard footsteps fading away deeper into the hall, along with some panting and a few wanton giggles. That was opportunity knocking. Rising slowly from my crouch, I peeked carefully over the windowsill. The hearth drew my attention first, off to my left. It was heating the contents of an iron pot craned over the flames, which Idun and Bragi were apparently willing to let stew for some time. Directly in front of me was the kitchen table, a wooden bowl of fruit on it. There were pears, plums, and peaches, but no apples. Imaginary Kirk spoke up. "Do you dare to eat a peach?" "Of course I dare," I whispered.
"May I remind you that we are here for the golden apple," Imaginary Spock said. "We should not be distracted by superfluous fruit."
I reached my hand through the open window and selected a plum from the bowl, figuring there would be no time to enjoy an entire peach. It was ripe and slightly soft underneath my fingers.
"Attaboy," Kirk said as I took a bite.
It was absurdly tasty. I grinned impishly and hoped it was a sign I could go with Plan C. I'd planned obsessively for this caper, plotting courses of action based on various contingencies all the way up to Q, but unfortunately hadn't included a duel with the Norns in any of them. Plan C involved leaving a note behind at the scene of the crime. Now the note was taking shape in my mind as I chewed on the plum. All I needed to do was find the apples. I silently buried the plum pit underneath the window with a whispered command to the earth. I untied the drawstring to my belt pouch by touch and removed a waterproof package of oilskin, which contained, among other things, some note-sized sheets of paper and a fountain pen for Plan C. I retrieved these after dissolving my camouflage, then quietly entered the hall while its owners took loud delight in each other. Once past the threshold, I saw to my right a wooden pedestal much like the one surrounding Freyr's hall. It had been invisible from the window, but it was prominent as one entered the door, ornately carved with figures that were most likely the Norse gods. A basket full of golden apples rested upon it, clearly an offering to anyone visiting. I grinned and continued to the kitchen table with my paper and pen. Plan C was a go. Taking inspiration from the modernist poet William Carlos Williams, I wrote a brief poem in Old Norse that would no doubt insult Bragi's sense of good taste, since skaldic poets had no patience with free verse. This is just to say, I have stolen the plums that were in your fruit bowl, and which you were probably saving for the Norns. Freya's tits. They were delicious, so sweet, and so cold. I signed it, "You're all stupid, you can lick me, Bacchus," and then stuffed every one of the plums into my pockets, leaving only pears and peaches in the bowl. I didn't care if they believed it was written by Bacchus or not. The entire point of the note was to throw them off my trail. They'd be looking for someone with hands capable of writing saucy modernist poetry, and I was shortly going to be hands-free. The moment of theft had arrived. Idun and Bragi were obligingly experimenting with the pleasurable effects of friction in their bedroom, and the golden apples of the gods beckoned invitingly near the open door. Continuing to tread softly, I picked one out of the basket and paused perversely to see if an alarm would sound. Idun wailed in ecstasy from the back of the hall and demanded that Bragi give her a baby, but I didn't think that counted. Moving as quickly as I could without making any noise, I went back to the river and tossed in all the plums. My feet left prints leading down to the riverbank, but that was all. It would be perfect if they thought I'd jumped in. They'd waste their time searching up and downstream for where I came out on the other side. I backed slowly away from the bank and had the earth fill in my prints as I walked, leaving the ones leading to the river alone. Eventually, I was under the orchard canopy, where the ground was a bit more firm and strewn with fallen leaves that softened my footfalls and disguised them, since there was a bit of moisture remaining in the leaves and they had yet to turn crunchy. Here, I hoped, was where I'd lose anyone trying to track me by smell. Placing the golden apple carefully in the crook of a tree branch, I stripped off everything and folded it into a neat pile, glad to be out of the damp leather. I wrote another quick note. "You take unusual delight in sheep asses, and everyone knows it. Neener, neener, Bacchus," and set it on top. The sword I placed off to one side. I asked the earth to part from me, and it obliged, opening a hole about 2 feet deep and about as wide. I placed the pile of clothes and my pouch inside with the note on top, and then had the earth bury it for me. I paused to say a few soft words for Ratatosk, because his bones were in my pouch. Then I redistributed leaves over the spot and rose, satisfied. If anyone, such as Heimdall, sniffed me out to this point and then dug up the clothes, they'd get nothing but frustrated. I sure hoped Odin was missing all of this. I took the apple down from the tree and laid it gently on the ground a few paces away. Then I slung Moralta across my body and adjusted the strap to a custom length so that it sagged ridiculously on my right side. The sword slid down my back, and I hitched it up, then got down on all fours so that the strap hung beneath my torso and even brushed the ground. After a few more tugs and shrugs to position the sword properly across my back, I was ready. I triggered the charm on my necklace that let me shapeshift into a stag, and when the transformation was complete, the sword and its strap was fitted snugly around my body. This procedure had taken much practice and many hours of making custom straps, but it was worth it since it was a part of plans A through Q. Now I could run much faster and still have the sword available in case I had to fight in close quarters. I gingerly picked up the golden apple between my deer lips and cast camouflage on myself, the apple, and Moralta. I was exuding a markedly different scent now that I was a deer. My werewolf friends in Arizona confirmed for me that they could not tell, strictly by scent, that I was the same being when I shapeshifted. And unless Odin somehow figured out what was going on, I didn't foresee any trouble getting back to Yggdrasil in maybe 5 or 6 hours, compared to the 8 it had taken me to get out here. Who was going to see a camouflaged stag running at night across the plains of Idaval? I wasn't naive enough to seriously believe I'd have no trouble, though. I just didn't foresee it. Chapter 4. Occasionally, I am smitten with an acute case of smug. It can happen to anyone, but it happens most often to people who think they've been especially clever. I felt a case of it coming on as I got closer and closer to Yggdrasil, with no signs of pursuit or even alarm. Through a combination of surprise, speed, and guile, I had thrown an entire pantheon into such confusion that they didn't know their legs from lutefisk. My supreme cock-up with the Norn should have balanced that out, but I was firmly blocking that and choosing to feel the smug instead. With about 10 miles to go, near the trunk of Yggdrasil, but still miles away from the route leading to Jotunheim, my acute case of smug turned to a gibbering case of, "Oh shit!" I believe that's a bona fide psychological term. If it isn't, it should be. I present my facts to a candid world. When a person steals anything from anyone and runs away, the first thing they say when they realize they're being chased is, "Oh shit," in whatever language they spoke as a child. It's really not possible to say anything else at that point. Some Britons cling to long-standing tradition and say, "Oh bugger," first, but once they confirm that they are, in fact, being chased, they invariably correct course and join the rest of humanity in saying, "Shit." Except for the part where I was a stag and I had an apple between lips that couldn't say it out loud anyway, I went the conventional route. When I saw what was after me, I screamed, "Oh shit," in my mind and did my best to achieve maximum warp. Scotty and his engines be damned. A routine paranoid check of my surroundings had revealed 2 ravens keeping pace above me. They hadn't been there 10 minutes earlier, during my last routine paranoid check. It meant Odin knew where I was, and it might also mean he was on his way to intercept me. I'm not sure how well the ravens could see me while I was camouflaged and running in the dark, but clearly it was well enough to locate my relative position. If nothing else, they could follow the sounds of my hooves pounding across the plain. An hour earlier, I had seen the golden trail of Gudlimbursti and dark clouds of Thor returning to Freyr's Hall. They appeared in the sky to the north, since I was returning a few miles to the south to avoid running into just such a party. They knew the Norns were missing, and perhaps they knew about Ratatosk as well. Now they were following the trail I'd left them. At least I knew they wouldn't be waiting for me at Yggdrasil. Yet a whisper of thunder behind me caused me to risk a look. The sound suggested a mass of cavalry, but instead it was only a single horse on the horizon. It was a massive horse, the height of a camel rather than any thoroughbred, and it had 8 legs rather than the 4 I was accustomed to seeing. It was Sleipnir, the steed of Odin, and on its back rode the one-eyed god, spear in hand. Above the horizon, 12 flying horses galloped in the air, each bearing an armored maiden with shield and sword. They were Valkyries, which meant the shit I was in was deeper than the Mariana Trench. They were the choosers of the slain on this plane, the Norse equivalent of the Morrigan, except with funny winged helmets, and somehow I didn't think they would choose Odin to die. I turned tail and ran for it. Cool, a chase scene, I thought manically, as I huffed around the apple in my lips. If I'd brought my iPod, I could have loaded in Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries for the soundtrack. Though, on reflection, it was dreary stuff and wouldn't lend me any speed. Perhaps it would have been more amusing and inspirational to play something culturally jarring and utterly absurd, like Jerry Reed's banjo anthem for those 70s bootlegging movies. Odin and the Valkyries could play the role of Smokey, and I'd be the legendary bandit. Odin looked a bit more competent than Sheriff Buford T. Justice, unfortunately, and I wasn't exactly moving like a 1977 Trans Am. The rumble of Sleipnir's hooves was growing steadily louder. He was gaining on me. Odin's spear, Gungnir, was a neat piece of magic like Moraltá or Fragora. Thanks to the runes carved on its head, it was always supposed to hit its target, and its target always died. That sort of magic tended to work. I had first-hand experience using both Fragora and Moraltá. I wondered, though, what kind of range he had. Did the magic work in such a way that he could simply target me, then give the spear a half-hearted throw in my general direction and let the runes do the rest? Or did he have to be within the range of his natural, albeit godlike, strength to chuck it after me? It was times like this when I wished I had a parietal eye. The blowing of a war horn forced me to look around. Valkyries don't blow war horns for the fun of it. They do so only with a purpose, as a signal in battle. I was in time to see Odin, still more than a quarter mile away, rise from his saddle and hurl Gungnir up into a high arc, the terminus of which was undoubtedly intended to be my heart or brain. At the same time, the Valkyries surged behind it, raising their swords and then pointing them all at me. My cold iron amulet sprouted frost crystals and trembled on my chest, and I knew that they had just chosen me to die. I suppose I could have depended on my amulet to protect me from their death sentence, but I'm too paranoid to leave everything up to a hunk of metal when I have options. What if the amulet didn't affect the targeting until the spear hit my aura? I couldn't let the spear get within a couple of inches of my skin and then try to dodge. I wanted to try out something else. My idea was to shake off both Gungnir's targeting and the Valkyrie's doom by changing the nature of the target. I bounded for a couple of leaps to the right to avoid the path of the spear, and then did three things in less than a second. I dissolved my camouflage, changed back into human form, and stopped running. The apple popped out of my human lips, and I caught it in my left hand. It was covered in deer slobber, but otherwise unmarred. The stag that Gungnir had been sent to kill wasn't there anymore, and I heard the spear whistle over my head before my eyes caught up to see it thud menacingly into the moor some 40 yards along my previous path. I checked on my pursuit and saw Odin and the Valkyries pull up to make sure they weren't hallucinating. They couldn't believe their eyes. The spear that never missed had just missed. The chosen slain wasn't slain, but prancing around naked in the plain of Idaval, with an apple in his hand and a defiant grin on his face. As they watched, the red-haired demon held up a hand in a clear signal for them to wait, then strode confidently toward Gungnir, as if it were no more than a common spear he had thrown himself. Then the creature had the unmitigated gall to lay his hands on it, Odin's spear, and yank it disrespectfully out of the ground. And then he... Odin bellowed at the Valkyries as he saw what I intended. He was not clad in full armor, but neither was he abroad as an avuncular traveler with a wide droopy hat and a gray cloak. He wore a spectacled helmet and a mail shirt under a tunic made of reindeer hide. He goaded his horse forward, and the Valkyries followed suit. It had been a long time since I'd thrown a spear or javelin, but it seemed like a good night to pick up the habit again. If Gungnir hit something, then they'd falter, and I'd get a chance to put some distance between us. If it missed, then they'd slow down to retrieve the weapon, and I'd still get a chance to put some distance between us. Directing my strength through my back and shoulder, and trying to remember my technique, I hurled the spear powerfully at my enemy's strategic weakness. Not at Odin, but at Sleipnir. Without pausing to watch its flight, I dropped immediately to all fours and shifted back into a stag, grasping the apple between my lips once more and shrugging against the fit of the scabbard strap. As I raised my head to resume my run, I saw the spear sink home at the base of the mighty stallion's throat, and he reared, neighing in pain and throwing Odin to the ground before he himself toppled. That almost made me drop the apple. I hadn't expected my aim to be that good. The runecraft must work for whoever threw the spear. The Valkyries immediately whirled around to help Odin, and I shagged it out of there while I had the chance. Two limp black forms rained out of the sky as I bounded toward the root, and I realized they were the ravens, Hugin and Munin, thought and memory. For them to fall meant Odin must be either unconscious or dead. I had to get out of there before I caused any more damage. I recast camouflage on myself, on the theory that the Valkyries wouldn't be able to see me without Odin's help, and worried about what to do next. Moraltau was a problem. There was no way I could afford to take it with me down Ratatosk's bolt hole in the root of Yggdrasil. Now that I was being pursued, I wouldn't have the necessary time to climb down that shaft using the excruciatingly slow process of binding my skin to the bark with every step. I had to fly down, but there was no way I could carry the sword as an owl. I had no choice but to leave it behind. Checking my six as I approached the root, I saw that a few Valkyries had taken to the air again, and they were circling aimlessly, looking for me. Hugin and Munin hadn't returned to the sky, so Odin was still out of it. Cursing the necessity, I returned to my human form and unslung the sword from my shoulders after I caught the apple popping from my mouth. I knelt on the ground and asked it to part for me. It did, accepting the sword that I drove straight down to the depths of my elbow, so that it would remain there like a spike in the earth. As satisfied as possible under the circumstances, I carefully closed the earth over it, making sure that the turf on top looked undisturbed, even going so far as to back away 10 paces and spending the effort to remove all traces of footprints. They might find it. If Heimdall knew to look for it, he probably would. But if I simply left while Odin was still zonked, there was no reason they wouldn't assume I'd taken it with me. I already had a reason to come back to Asgard in any case. I'd promised my attorney and friend, the vampire Leif Helgerson, that I would bring him there to settle an old grudge against Thor the violent way. I shapeshifted to a great horned owl and picked up the apple in my talons as gingerly as possible. I couldn't avoid puncturing its thin skin a little bit, but I figured Laksha would just have to deal with it. I flew up to the hole in the root, and then, once over the lip, folded my wings against the sides of my body and dove for the bottom. After swooping out of the hole underneath Asgard, I dove again for the bottom of the root. The well of Mimir was unattended, as it had been when I arrived. Mimir had long since been beheaded by the Vanir, but I expected that such an important sight would be watched. Since it was now Black Friday, perhaps its keeper was off somewhere taking advantage of a doorbuster sale. I pulled out of my dive, dropped the apple in the snow, and shifted to plain old Atticus. I promptly began to shiver. Hugging the tree root and clutching the blasted apple, I found the tether to Earth and pulled my center along it until I returned to what everyone thinks of as the real world. It was just as cold in Siberia as it was in Jotunheim, and I had no clothes. I groaned out loud and took a moment to enjoy the feeling of not being chased. I also needed to give my body a bit of a break. Despite the fact that all the energy I'd used had come from the Earth, the rapid shape-shifting was taking its toll. I felt shaky and weak, and my liver wanted to know if it would get to spend some time in its wanted shape. Unfortunately, the answer was no. I wasn't out of danger yet. The Norse were perfectly capable of following me to this plane, and I had no doubt that they would, sooner or later. Once they followed my clear trail to Idun and Bragi's hall, they'd start to piece things together. If they found my buried clothes in the orchard, they'd know I came from Midgard. If they found the Norns, they'd know a sword killed them. If they found Moraltah, they'd recognize it as a Fey weapon and chase that lead until they found out the truth, namely, the being responsible for stealing a golden apple and knocking Odin on his ass wasn't a demon or a god, but rather a druid. I hoped they wouldn't find that out until much later, if at all. My primary advantage right now was my anonymity. Once Odin woke up and couldn't find me in Asgard, he might waste time looking around Jotunheim until someone figured out I'd come from Midgard. Taking a couple of deep breaths to brace myself, and with apologies to my liver, I shifted once more to a stag and picked up the golden apple. The run south to the forest took me only 2 hours instead of three. I'd never been so relieved to see a friendly bunch of trees. Once I shifted planes to Tir na n'Og, I'd be able to recover a cache of clothes I'd left there and make myself presentable. I wanted to shift to North Carolina this afternoon and place the apple in Laksha's hand with cavalier indifference, as if stealing it had been no more taxing than running to the local grocery store. She had slain 12 Bakkens without breaking a sweat, something I'd never be able to do, so in terms of badass grandstanding, I needed to make this caper appear as if it had cost me nothing, even though it might end up costing me everything. It had already occurred to me that Laksha might be hoping I'd never return from the trip, and that the whole arrangement was an elaborate way to marshal me to knavery. Part of her, perhaps a very large part, would be disappointed that I'd succeeded without a scratch to show for it. Thinking of how surprised she'd be made me smile. I was, in fact, dangerously close to contracting another acute case of smug. But just before I cozied up to an old oak and shifted to Tir na n'Og, I looked up at the sky and saw two ravens circling above me. To the north, dark thunderclouds were boiling rapidly in my direction. Odin was awake. Those damn ravens really could see through my camouflage. And Thor the Thunder Thug was on his way to settle accounts.